and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced 12 new indictments targeting alleged Russian intelligence operatives for interfering in the 2016 election. This move comes ahead of the highly anticipated summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. Next, President Trump continues his working visit to the UK today as tens of thousands of people protested in front of the US embassy. This morning, he met with British Prime Minister Theresa May to discuss a possible post-Brexit trade deal and proceeded to give an interview denouncing her government's new economic strategy for exiting the European Union. Then, a high-level delegation, including the secretaries of the Treasury, Homeland Security, and State, along with senior Trump advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner, has arrived in Mexico to meet with incoming President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Elected in a landslide, López Obrador has wasted no time in rolling out major policy proposals, including a possible grand bargain with the United States. And then the Trump administration was only able to reunite fewer than half of the eligible migrant families in its care by a court-ordered deadline of Tuesday, as the fates of thousands more remain in limbo. Last night, lawyers for the administration and immigrant rights advocates clashed over further measures to ensure the timely reunification of immigrant children with their parents. And finally, thank God it's Friday. We'll end our show, as always, with the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Justice Department. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced 12 new indictments targeting alleged Russian intelligence operatives for interference in the 2016 presidential election. This move comes ahead of the highly anticipated summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, Finland. We're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys.
So, Jim, we were speculating here at the station, who could be indicted? When Justice first made this announcement today that there was going to be a new indictment coming down, we thought maybe it's Michael Cohen, maybe it's Donald Trump Jr., and it turned out to be 12 Russians. So what do you make of this?
Well, you know, we see every time there's a couple of days before some meeting or something that looks like it's going to lessen tensions between Russia and the United States, something comes out, okay? So this has come out. Now, this is clearly Mueller's shot against the Russians. This is the meat of the matter insofar as Russian hacking is concerned. They're claiming he's got the goods on these guys who are GRU agents. So we'll have to see. But it's extremely suspicious that, you know, the day before the meeting or a couple of days before the meeting of Trump and Putin, this comes out. You know, the day after Trump announces he wants to pull troops from Syria, there's a fake gas attack in Duma, and the ripples show up another time. So this is something that we have to be skeptical about. It's an indictment. You can indict a ham sandwich, and you know, there's no particular evidence in it, but there's a lot of assertions that are extremely specific, and we'll have to see how it plays out. So I think, you know, what we have here is the meat of the Russian hacking matter. That's going to come from Mueller, and he's bringing it out at the time when it's most likely to scuttle the Trump Putin thing. So, and we have to realize, everybody has to realize that, you know, what, first of all, this is a lot about Guccifer 2.0.
Yep.
Nobody took Guccifer 2.0 at face value. Okay. The original Guccifer, who was a real guy, who was a real hacker, who was convicted in Romania and the United States, he said, and I'm going to read you this, I think Guccifer 2.0 is something made from some guys at the State Department, some guys from the Cyber Command of the NSA, some guys from the Vault 7 of the CIA. I'm in this business for sort of 15 years now. This is my take. The Russians are more skillful than this to let tracks in the documents point to them. So this is made by the other guys who wanted to point to the Russians. We have to realize that this Vault 7 stuff that was the WikiLeaks show, the CIA has the ability to create fake false flag hacking tracks, essentially, to create clues that go back to another source. And, you know, we have to see. So we have to take nothing of this for granted. We have to see and analyze the evidence that's presented that purports to show tracking back to these particular individuals. It's a very difficult thing to do in today's computer environment where things can be spoofed and faked.
So tell me something, too. These charges are not what you might expect to see. There's conspiracy to commit computer fraud. There's aggravated identity theft and one charge of money laundering.
Yeah.
So what does all that mean?
What else can they charge them with? It's computer fraud. It's stealing identities. It's moving money through, you know, again, they always have the ability to charge people for moving money through American controlled financial outlets and banking outlets. But yeah, these are not charges of, you know, not blowing anything up or killing anybody. They're, you know, they did some hacking. I mean, they illegally, surreptitiously entered a computer they shouldn't have been in, and they took information they shouldn't have had, and they stole identities. They posed as real persons. They say that in this. So, you know, what else can they charge them with? So it's not, you know, even if they were convicted, I don't know what the charges might be in the United States. The sentences are so ridiculous they could get a bad sentence. But, you know, they're not coming over here. The GRU agents aren't coming over here to face trial. And they know that too. So this is another one of these circumstances where they're pretty sure they're never going to have to present the evidence in court in a seriously contested way.
I agree with you. I wanted to ask you just about that point you just made in terms of these people being Russians who live in Russia, and, you know, unless they get some wild idea to come to the United States to fight these charges, not going to happen. We'll never actually get like an adversarial court proceeding where these people can defend themselves. I mean, most likely what they'll do is just not travel to the United States anymore. This isn't the first time that the Mueller investigation has produced indictments targeting people who do not live in the United States and in all likelihood will not come to the United States and therefore, you know, will never face trial. What do you make of that tactic? It sort of has a lot of political utility, right?
Yeah, sure. It's going to be fought out where it's fought out now, you know, on Twitter and in the news and in the media. You know, there'll be different interpretations of this, depending upon how much evidence, specific evidence, the Mueller people deign to put out. But the previous example of that, what was the name of that company?
Oh, the Internet Research Agency, right? Which sounds like an official government agency, but is actually just a private company.
That was a private company, and they did show up in court. They did. Their lawyers came and said, "We'll come and we'll."
Yeah, and they wanted discovery. Sure.
Yeah. So, but the difference here is that these are GRU agents. I mean, they have other information. The Russian government isn't going to allow them to come and precisely stand on the ground. You know, stand trial for these, like, you money laundering, or you moved money through banks you shouldn't have made these Bitcoin transactions, or you stole someone's identity, or you hacked into a computer and because they get them into United States custody. I mean, these are serious agents. I mean, they're not going to let a CIA agent be extradited to Moscow on charges of hacking a computer in Moscow. So, you know, so these guys, this is not a private, precisely the other people showing up kind of demonstrated the fact in some sense that you know, they must not have very serious other kinds of state information that they could be pressured to release. So the GRU agents aren't coming. I mean, I'm seriously doubtful if they would. But, you know, presumably there'll be a Russian state response to this of some kind. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to overstate the connection between the Helsinki summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in this release now, but I think that it is reasonable to think that there's a connection here because, you know, in addition to sort of the history of these, you know, news developments, the Skripals, the Duma alleged chemical attack coming out, you know, to alter some sort of decision-making course that the Trump administration seems to be on. I mean, in addition to that sort of historical stuff, I think that it's clear that Mueller can get an indictment whenever. And in fact, it's not just Mueller. It's any prosecutor can get an indictment from a grand jury more or less whenever they want, right? I mean, it doesn't. So the timing is intentional. I mean, they could have done this on Tuesday as opposed to Friday. They could have done it the day after the Helsinki meeting. They could have done it. They probably could have done it like a month ago, you know. So this timing is intentional. It's not like nobody at the Justice Department, it's not like they're all stupid and don't know what's going on in the world. I mean, they must have known what this would come off as, and perhaps that was intentional.
Well, I agree with you. As you say, they could have chosen to withhold this for a couple of days. They could have chosen to do it probably earlier. Any prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. And so, you know, one does have to look at this skeptically. I'm not going to say I wouldn't put it out of the realm of possibility that this is true, that the GRU was hacking But I wonder what other computers they might have been hacking. You know what I mean? They probably weren't just hacking the DNC, but that's another story. But that the GRU was somehow behind Guccifer 2.0 character, as opposed to what Guccifer 1.0 says, it's probably the Americans created. I think most of the people who were looking at this seriously always thought that Guccifer 2.0 was some kind of confected identity by somebody. So it wouldn't, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the GRU did this, but you know, we can't take this for granted because there's been an indictment, and we should be very suspicious of the way that the timing of the presentation that indictment, which was unnecessary.
I have a lot of friends actually in the hacker community. They call themselves hacktivists, and they're loosely affiliated with Anonymous and other groups. And to a man, they are adamant that Guccifer 2.0 is Russian intelligence. They say it all the time. I mean, it's impossible to know.
It's absolutely possible. It's absolutely possible. And I know that a lot of the people who spoke, you know, everybody said Guccifer 2.0 is some kind of confected character. Many of them said it was Russian intelligence. Some of them others said what Guccifer 1.0 said, this is American intelligence. You know, it could be either, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't change any particular, it's if not that great political significance to me, who it is.
No, I agree. Well, that was the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. Jim joined us from New York and is the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
President Donald Trump continues his working visit to the UK today as tens of thousands of people protested in front of the U.S. Embassy. This morning, he met with British Prime Minister Theresa May to discuss a possible post-Brexit trade deal. We're joined from Edinburgh, Scotland by John White. John's the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show Hard Facts. John, welcome back.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
John, we're watching pretty much every news network here in the States, and all we see is protests and more protests. And then we see the president insulting Theresa May, saying that Boris Johnson would be a great prime minister, and saying that there likely will not be a trade deal between the U.S. and the U.K. Contextualize this visit for us. What is this visit doing for our relationship?
Well, I have to tell you, in all candor, I have never seen anything quite like this in all my years in politics and geopolitics. Fresh from his appearance at the NATO summit in Brussels, where Trump proceeded to puncture decades of diplomatic niceties and US commitment to the Western military alliance, he arrived in the UK for his official visit with UK Prime Minister Theresa May, wielding Brexit dagger, which he proceeded to used to knife her in the back in the course of an interview he gave to Rupert Murdoch's popular right-wing populist tabloid newspaper, The Sun, which is the cash cow of Murdoch's UK arm of his vast media empire, in which he railed against Theresa May's attempt to arrive at a soft Brexit, which would involve continuing some ties to the EU on the part of the UK, and then talked up the prospects and talents of Boris Johnson, her notorious foreign secretary, who only just resigned from the job in protest at her decision to opt for a soft Brexit. And this bears all the hallmarks of a Macbethian plot, because I am convinced that Boris Johnson knew that Trump was going to come out with this interview. And the fact that he used Rupert Murdoch's tabloid newspaper, The Sun, Rupert Murdoch, we know, is a close friend and ally of Donald Trump, and he's an advocate of a hard Brexit. And given Rupert Murdoch's much-deserved, if not maligned, reputation as a kingmaker of UK politics, I think this was a concocted interview designed to wield the knife and to destroy the remnants of Theresa May's leadership. It's never been so weak, with the idea of Boris Johnson taking her place, though there has been one almighty backlash to that interview, which has resulted in Trump backtracking from his comments to the Sun News during his joint press conference with Theresa May at Chequers afterwards.
Absolutely right. I was struck, too, by some of the reactions to British parliamentarians, both on the right and the left. The universities minister, Sam Gyimah, tweeted, "Where are your manners, Mr. President?" And then the Labour Party, as a party, issued a statement calling Trump extraordinarily rude. So, John, your comment that you've never seen anything like this in your adult life is quite consistent with what other people are saying in the UK right now.
Well, I mean, the idea that Russia can be accused of interfering in Britain's internal affairs with regard to Brexit, with only a few tweets being cited as evidence, and here's a president arriving on the scene to lambast the country's government over its Brexit stance and to talk up the prospects of his preferred candidate for the role of Prime Minister. I mean, the man arrived more like a New York crime boss picking his new underboss, choosing Boris Johnson over the incumbent Theresa May. And if anybody needed any confirmation that the UK is a glorified vassal state of the US, then surely this is it.
I can think of maybe two main reasons why Donald Trump would decide to attack so strongly the new economic strategy that the Theresa May government has proposed. And it was the unveiling of that new strategy, which is, you know, like you were saying, John, a significant softening of the Brexit process, whereby the UK would maintain significant economic ties with the European Union, even when it formally leaves the European Union. I can think of two reasons why he would decide to attack that with such intensity. I mean, one is ideological, right? He has like an ideological affinity with the forces that are generally associated with the far right in the UK. That could be UKIP, or, you know, Boris Johnson is in the mainstream Conservative Party, but he's considered to be to the right of Theresa May. And they're very invested in, you know, this Eurosceptic position in the UK, you know, a desire to have a full and complete break. But there's also an economic reason, and that's that it undermines the ability of U.S. corporations to get the upper hand in the new trade arrangement between the United States and the UK after the UK leaves the European Union, right? Because the European Union negotiates trade deals as a bloc. If the UK has some sort of economic union of one type or another with the EU, even after it leaves, then that weakens the US economic bargaining position. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Let me take both of those points seriatim. The first one about the far right, it is absolutely the case that Trump has spearheaded a recrudescence of nativist sentiment all throughout the West, in the US, and also here in the UK. The far right has never enjoyed such traction as it does now. We're seeing far right demonstrations taking place on a regular basis with increasing numbers in the thousands, where before they were only in the hundreds. And Trump made it his business when he arrived in the UK to also rail against Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan is London's Muslim mayor, and he blamed Khan for the uptick in terrorist attacks that have taken place in the UK, specifically in London in recent years, and also for the problem, the crime wave that has hit London. He also railed against immigration as a reason, the primary reason for Brexit, which on that I have to agree with him. On the second point regarding economics, again, you are spot on, Walter, because we know that the vultures of US private healthcare companies are circling over the NHS. The NHS is a glittering prize for them, a massive state-funded healthcare provider, the largest in the world by far, the largest employer in the UK by far, which would not be able to function without the role of migrants, migrant doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals. And this stands as the last remaining redoubt of socialist policies in the UK, the hangover from the post-Second World War transforming Labour government, which helped to expand the contours of the welfare state. The NHS is one of the last remaining redoubts of social solidarity as the underpinnings of the country's economy and society. And it's no secret that private healthcare companies in the US are angling to get a piece of that pie. And if the UK completely withdraws from the EU, then the NHS will be rendered immediately vulnerable to their attentions. This is what's on offer, and this is largely driving Trump's stance when it comes to the UK and its future relations with the EU. You're absolutely right on that.
You know, I wonder, too, if there really is a strategy or if he's just winging it. We were talking amongst ourselves before we called you here in the studio, and we were recalling that when Donald Trump was first asked about Brexit during the campaign, he didn't know what it was, and he just made something up as an answer that made no sense because he had never heard the word Brexit before. And so I wonder how deeply he actually understands this thing. So when he comes out with an opinion, should we trust his opinion to be his actual opinion, or is he just trying to be a controversialist, as one British politician called him?
Well, there's no doubt that he seems to shift his positions day by day. I think he's cleverer than a lot of people have given him credit for. I think he believes that the stance of keeping his allies and opponents, I don't think he's able to distinguish which is which, keeping them off balance is helpful in arriving at the policies and the objectives that he wants for himself. I say himself over the country. I believe Donald Trump is really in office to help himself more than he is to serve anyone. But I do think this is part of his shtick, whereby he feels that he can come along and upset the apple cart of allies and then be nice to them the next again day and try and build them up again in order to keep them off balance, keep them guessing. I think this is a shtick that he's used throughout his business career, and I think he thinks he can bring those talents or supposed talents to the political realm. He's certainly not a very thoughtful man in that sense. He's certainly not a deep thinker. I think he's all about doing deals. And he's certainly obviously prey to the advice of whoever's in favour and within his circle right now. You know, John Bolton, McMaster, and people like that have got his ear. Before that, it was Steve Bannon and people from the alt-right. So I do think there's a residue of alt-right thinking in his Brexit stance and in his stance on immigration, which is probably one of the few policies and the few stances that he has been consistent on from the very beginning of his campaign for president.
So let me read this quote from Trump at a press conference. "I would give our relationship with the UK, and now especially that have 2 days with your prime minister, I would say the highest level of special." So if you fight through what he was talking about there, he was making a reference to the, quote, special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. We just have about 30 seconds left, but that's probably a phrase that our listeners may hear in different news outlets today. What is the special relationship?
Well, that's the post-Second War relationship that was undertaken under Churchill's behest when Churchill was still the Prime Minister, with his Fulton, Missouri speech, which he gave in 1946 after leaving office as Prime Minister, which he did in 1945. And this was meant to be the bulwark of Western politics and Western security in the Cold War years. I think the special relationship is more special on this side of the Atlantic in the UK than it has ever been in Washington, I think, as Trump has proved. But as previous presidents have proved, the UK is dancing to America's tune, and it always has done on security, on geopolitics, on cultural issues, and also economically, given that neoliberalism is essentially a US economic model. The special relationship has impeded democracy in the UK, as far as I am concerned, and has done a lot to disrupt the UK's natural relationships with its European partners, including Russia. My strong view is that the malign influence in Europe's affairs has never been Moscow and has always been Washington. So we need a greater Europe that includes Moscow and excludes Washington.
We have to leave it right there. We were joined from Edinburgh, Scotland by John White. John is the host of the weekly Sputnik radio show, Hard Facts. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
A high-level delegation, including the secretaries of the Treasury, Homeland Security, and State, along with senior Trump advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner, has arrived in Mexico to meet with incoming President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Elected in a landslide, López Obrador has wasted no time in rolling out major policy proposals, including a possible grand bargain with the United States. We're joined from Mexico City by Dr. John Ackerman. He's a professor of constitutional law at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, researcher at the Legal Research Institute of UNAM, and editorial director of the Mexican Law Review. Dr. Ackerman, welcome back.
Pleasure to be with you as always.
So I hear this term grand bargain, and it reminds me of what George W. Bush thought he could accomplish just before 9/11 with this agreement with Mexico that would have allowed people to come across the border to work in the United States, pay taxes, and then go home at the end of the whatever it was, the growing season or whatever. Is that what we're talking about here? What kind of grand bargain? Is it? Is it trade? Is it refugees? What exactly is it?
Well, we'll see how things pan out. You know, López Obrador has just won. He hasn't even been officially recognized by the Electoral Tribunal as president-elect. This will happen soon, of course. And he will take power on December 1st. We have this very long transition period of 5 months. The thing that is very clear is that the Mexican people have said, you know, very, very clearly in the polls that they want to change both in terms of domestic policy, but also in terms of relationships with Trump and the United States. They want an end to this kind of servile attitude which we've been seeing from Peña Nieto and Videgaray, and we want Mexicans, the Mexico's new government, Obrador in particular, to stand up with respect, but stand up and defend Mexico and Mexicans' dignity towards the United States. López Obrador has a very strong mandate, right? So 53% of the vote is, unheard of in recent Mexican history.
Sure.
And that, I think, will actually give him a larger margin of negotiation than if it had been smaller. If it had been smaller, maybe he would have to use the relationship with Trump for more demagogic, playing to his base in Mexico, as Trump does with the Mexican United States. But with this incredible mandate, I think López Obrador, the Mexican people are going to give him a benefit of the doubt to be able to sit down with Trump and, negotiate a restart in relationship to Mexico and the United States. And this would, of course, have to mean, a defense of Mexicans in the United States. The wall, I think, would have to be out of the question. I can't imagine López Obrador accepting the wall, and much less, of course, paying for it, and a real demand for respect by the U.S. government towards Mexico. López Obrador has said that his solution to the immigration problem, his solution to the violence issue and the drug issue, is development and more development and attending to poverty in Mexico, especially particularly in the Mexico South. So if Trump is smart and responds to that call in a positive way, which, you guys know better than I am that he's not always smart in his responses, but if he knew really how to play this game, he would be able to, I think, very quickly have positive relationship with Mexico if he's willing to actually, invest in Mexico and take Mexico and look further seriously.
Yeah, and I think that would be such a win for Mexico, and I think that would be a good thing for the people of the world. I mean, Trump during the campaign said that he was going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. I mean, how amazing would it be if the Mexican government is able to maneuver in such a way that, in fact, it's the United States paying Mexico for infrastructure projects and other developments.
Let's build walls, but building in Mexico, not on the wall.
Yeah. And López Obrador has also made reference to the Alliance for Progress, the initiative of the Kennedy administration in Latin America following the Cuban Revolution, I think, in response to the Cuban Revolution. Tell us a little bit about that, both historically and what he might be talking about in today's terms.
Yeah, he made explicit references to the Alliance for Progress. Basically what he's trying to put on the table there is that instead of the bilateral relationship being based on violence and on military support, for there to be, actually an alliance in favor of development and the economy in Mexico. And so this would mean a real radical transformation, because up till today there's been basically emphasis on in the summit has been how many new Black Hawk helicopters Mexico is going to purchase from the United States, how much new intelligence information Mexico is going to hand over to the United States officials in exchange for, not cutting off NAFTA or other kinds of economic issues. And here we would have a, real inversion in the priorities. Instead of just talking about guns and violence, we'd be talking about development and progress. Now, López Obrador is going to have to walk a very fine line here, a real balancing act, because he's really put together a wide coalition of people on the left and the right, even some of the radical left and some of the radical right are with him at this moment. So he is a leftist politician, comes from that tradition, has that political culture, has those proposals, but has also been very concerned about maintaining a unified coalition. In the end, getting along well with Trump in the United States, he's not looking to provoke binational conflict. So you can see how this is going to be very complex, especially in the beginning of the government.
We're speaking from Mexico City with Dr. John Ackerman, a professor of constitutional law at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Dr. Ackerman, it's very unusual, highly unusual, for multiple cabinet secretaries to be in one foreign country at the same time. And here we have the secretaries of the Treasury, Homeland Security, and State along with Jared Kushner, all in the same place. What's the reaction like in Mexico? To me, this seems like it would be a sign of seriousness.
Yes, I think that's basically the impression. The press is going crazy right now down here in Mexico, very, very excitedly covering this very important visit by all these leading Trump officials. And it's symbolically also important that López Obrador has have them come over to his very humble transition offices, his campaign offices, which are, it's a nice house in a, middle-class neighborhood, but it's not any kind of palatial kind of reception. He's just, inviting them, and they've agreed to come over and visit him and his transition team and, just meet each other and exchange letters. López Obrador is handing over a letter which is basically requesting this idea of economic solidarity and working together on that realm instead of the question of violence and control. And so symbolically in Mexico, it's having a big impact. It's very interesting. I was looking at the U.S. press, and it's not being covered at all, at least as far as I can see. Because Trump is doing his thing in Europe. He's on the verge of a meeting with Putin on Monday, just coming out of this meeting with NATO. But it's interesting for me to see that. I've been looking at the U.S. press. There's not even a mention of the fact that this very powerful group of cabinet ministers are coming not only to meet with Peña Nieto, but actually to meet with López Obrador, who is not even, I insist, he's not even president-elect. He's won the elections, but he hasn't actually gotten legal recognition of this. And so there's an interesting two sides to the story as well.
I want to ask you about NAFTA. We have just a little bit over 2 minutes left, because the politics around NAFTA, leaving the economics to the side for a moment, is very mixed up right now, because, of course, when NAFTA was implemented, the left, both in the United States and in Mexico, was militantly opposed to it. I mean, the reason why the Zapatista uprising began on January 1st, 1994, is because that's when NAFTA went into effect. But now we're in a position where the NAFTA renegotiations appears to be used as it's an offensive move by the United States against Mexico. And now it seems like the forces that would otherwise be opposed to NAFTA are sort of shifting. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that phenomenon.
Yes, indeed. It's a very strange situation. So López Obrador himself and, the Mexican left, as you said, has been very anti-NAFTA. The problem is that now that we're, 24 years into NAFTA almost, it's changed the economy in mostly negative ways, making Mexico more dependent on the United States, leading to this mass immigration and without significant economic development and much less increase in real wages. But we're now more dependent than ever on the United States economy. So if the United States just suddenly, closed off international commerce with Mexico, this would, send the Mexican economy into a massive tailspin, and it would be disastrous. Even more disastrous than NAFTA would be the, rapid end of NAFTA, ironically. And so López Obrador has, basically been positive about NAFTA. He's been positive about the renegotiation of NAFTA. Let's try to put in more, protections for workers, for the environment. And if NAFTA doesn't continue, obviously it wouldn't be the end of the world, because then we would have, binational agreements. The advantage, ironically, of NAFTA today is that with, Canada is not exactly a progressive government, but it's not Trump. And so there's a possibility with this three-way negotiations to have, Canada and Mexico joining together on certain issues, in terms of labor rights and stuff like that, which could, improve NAFTA. That's the hope. Trump himself has said, in order to sign NAFTA, we need to increase the minimum wage in Mexico. López Obrador grabbed onto that immediately and said, yes, I agree with you. We need to increase the minimum wage in Mexico. So we have these kind of ironic meeting of minds, and we'll see how this all turns out in the next few months. Remember, Peña Nieto is still at the helm until December 1st.
Yeah. And remember, only Nixon could go to China, so maybe we'll all be surprised in a good way. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Mexico City by Dr. John Ackerman, professor of constitutional law at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He's also a researcher at the Legal Research Institute there and editorial director of the Mexican Law Review. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, filling in for Brian Becker.
The Trump administration was only able to reunite fewer than half of the eligible migrant families in its care by a court-ordered deadline of this past Tuesday, as the fates of thousands more remain in limbo. Last night, lawyers for the administration and immigrant advocates clashed over further measures to ensure the timely reunification of immigrant children with their parents. We're joined from Chicago by Angie Kim. Angie is an immigrant rights activist. Angie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
This is such a difficult, terrible issue to even have to talk about. I saw yesterday on one of the news shows a commentator saying, look, a commentator who's an attorney saying, look, this is kidnapping. That's all it is. This is felony kidnapping. You cannot take somebody's child just like that. Where do you think this whole issue is going? The administration clearly cannot get its act together to the point where families are being reunited. At least not enough families are being reunited. Where do we go from here?
This has definitely been a very difficult issue for me to talk about. I think, you know, to a certain level, I think I've been kind of avoiding it, seeing how I can compose myself emotionally. But first, I think the current situation is a huge mess. And I couldn't agree more and with the statement. I think this is beyond unconstitutional. I mean, this is just purely wrong. No matter what the circumstances are, for any agency or institution to forcefully separate children as young as, you know, 5, 1, 2 from their parents has to be, a violation of human rights. I mean, this overrides all, border laws and issues around immigration and legalization. I mean, this is about moral values, and this is about doing what is right by our standards. And this really is a kidnapping. This is a kidnapping that's being implemented by our own government.
I think that's exactly right. And I am happy that the court currently is at least being supportive of these families and trying to get them back together. But I'm really, I guess, not surprised, but really frustrated that the court is accepting at this point that the Trump administration has, quote unquote, reunited all eligible families. What does eligible mean? I mean, it the way that they're talking about it means people who are eligible include people who passed background checks or who passed DNA checks. I'm deeply, deeply skeptical of that, and also aware that these are people who often were applying for asylum, which is obviously an international law and right that people have to do. So the government kind of interfering and looking into criminal history, looking into background checks, looking into biological relationship. It's a huge interference in something that shouldn't have happened ever at all. I mean, what do you think about this eligibility criteria that they're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, it does get very sort of complicated and very nuanced. And I think the messaging that's coming from the administration in the courts oftentimes kind of generalizes what's really happening. And it's actually not true. You know, it just, in terms of sheer numbers, the White House had a deadline, which was Monday, to reunite all children under the age of 5. Now, just to start off there, that is about 1% of the total number of children that have been separated. So we're already, you know, starting off with both of our feet and hands tied at that point, because that's a very small percentage of the entire population of children who are currently detained and separated from their parents. And 700 parents of kids have not been identified. And to add to that, there's numerous situations, circumstances to which they're giving reasons to why the children and the parents have not been reunited. And they're not sharing actually families who can't be reunited, right? They don't want to highlight that, which is their parents of children who are detained who already have been deported. So what do you do with children who are now in different countries from their parents? How do you reunite them, right? And those are the things that they don't want to highlight. And this is, what we've seen so far is, you know, I like to add that this was an injunction that was put in by the judge, right? The White House did not take it upon themselves to reunite the family. They were forced to do so. And now they're dragging their feet, you know, giving all kinds of reasons as to why children and parents are not reunited at the rate that we would like to be or that they can be. And so this is, you know, purely an excuse. There really should not be any logical, you know, reasons as to why children can't be reunited with their parents. You know, they're also using criminal background or histories of parents to block any reunification. So, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And I, it's really also extremely galling that some of these parents, as you said, have already been deported. I mean, that really indicates that the administration had never really thought through the idea of reunification until a court told them to, which only happened because an outside organization sued in the first place. It's really makes kind of clear what their intent and how much thought they had put into this, which you point out is literally kidnapping. I mean, this is criminal, separating a family across borders. That's, you know, we've seen this in the past in some of our worst world history, and it's not pretty, and it's not okay, and it's not legal. It's not okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think that it would be an exaggeration to say that this is a repetition of some of the horrible, you know, acts, you know, put on to civilians and citizens and just people in our society in this country by the government, like the Japanese internment camps or the Chinese Exclusion Act, where, you know, people have been violated, you know, based on, you know, their country of origin or their race or their ethnicity. I mean, this is a criminal act that is imposed by our own government. And I think it's safe to say. You know, I also want to point out there's a lot of speculations around, you know, solutions to reunifying, but also how to sort of move forward with families and parents who will continue to be detained at the border. And, you know, there's a lot of efforts and messaging that the Congress or the White House have sort of, quote unquote, resolved this issue. But, you know, we have learned that parents now who are with children 5 years or older, although they might be kept together, they will be detained in family detention centers indefinitely. And actually, these facilities do separate fathers and mothers. So fathers will be sent to a separate detention centers and mothers, but either one of those guardians will be able to remain with their children, but detained nonetheless. So this, in a way, is still a family separation.
Right. And we're still jailing people for, you know, applying for asylum or for looking for something better for their families. I also wanted to ask you about, you know, the court drew the line at ages 4 and younger and then ages 5 and above. But age 5 is still very young and you are still really forming who you are, forming bonds to your parents. Really important things all the way up until, you know, your brain is still changing until you're 25. So all of the children who are affected by this are absolutely being affected really negatively by being separated from their parents. And we know that there's another several thousand, maybe 3,000 children between 5 and 17 who will also hopefully be reunited with their parents. But given that we've seen the administration return, I think it's in the 50s, the children under 5 who have been returned to their families, the 2,000 or 3,000 children who are a little bit older, that's definitely going to be something that the administration will struggle with, I think. Have you heard anything about how that might look?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, I think the age of 5 is pretty arbitrary. I mean, I think realistically speaking, I would say anything under age, you know, 18 would be considered, you know, they're considered a minor and in needing a guardianship and protectors. And to say that, you know, we could treat somehow 5-year-old children and up, you know, with less urgency is absurd. I mean, and also we're hearing stories of 5-year-olds having to represent themselves in courtrooms. I don't really understand how that would happen, but that's what we're hearing.
You know, there's actually been video, too, of 5-year-olds going into court and, for example, not knowing what a lawyer is. Well, I saw one just yesterday where the judge asked a little boy in Spanish, do you have a lawyer? And he just stood there. And then he asked the little boy, do you know what a lawyer is? And the boy said, no.
There is funding. There are resources. The U.S. government has.
But this was a policy decision.
Amount of wealth.
Sure.
Right. They're all policy decisions.
Sure. This was a policy decision to deny basic rights and due process for children.
And reunification for families,
exactly.
Which if we devoted the entire Department of Defense and intelligence communities, which are very good at ferreting out information, to instead reunifying families,
right.
I feel pretty positively
we
could figure
that
out.
We wouldn't be talking about this. That's right. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Angie Kim. Angie's an immigrant rights activist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break and come back with more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at our worst, most misleading, and funniest headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets, at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And we are joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome to everybody.
Thanks so much.
Hi.
So, Nicole, I'm going to turn this over to you. Steve has given us a lot to laugh
to work
about. So tell me what you think is the funniest or the most misleading.
There's some good ones today. Steve, why don't we start with the State Department? What do we get out of the State Department today?
Okay, well, this was the weirdest one or funniest one. I don't know. My favorite one for sure. U.S. State Department calls out Russia on eroding press freedoms.
Oh, my God.
Now, I'm not an expert on the Russian press. I know all about RT and Sputnik in this country and their English language broadcasts, which I listen to regularly. I'm not a Russian. I've not been in Russia, so I don't know what the press situation is in Russia. But that's not what this article is all about. This article calls out Russia on eroding press freedoms for one reason and one reason only, and that's because Russia fined Radio Free Europe for not registering under its FARA Act. Which is like,
oh,
it's
my
like
God.
The ultimate irony or hypocrisy or...
Yeah, all that, I think.
It's just preposterous.
Wow.
Yeah, so for our listeners who may not know or may not remember, a while ago, RT and Sputnik were forced to register under the United States' Foreign Agent Registration Act, which, you know, was obviously a ludicrous attack on press freedom and alternative press. But now that Russia has responded in kind, Steve, what you're saying is that now CBS News that put out this article, this headline that we're talking about now, and I'm sure there may be similar articles in other news outlets, now they're saying, oh my God, Russia is cracking down on Radio Free Europe, which is the U.S. public broadcaster.
They're eroding press freedoms.
Right. I mean, we don't blame CBS News for this headline, really. I mean, they're just accurately reporting a U.S. State Department press release.
Yeah, true.
So it's the State Department which is committing this hypocrisy, not CBS News.
Which, look, I mean, we felt like our press freedoms were being eroded. So, I mean, I think that's definitely what the FARA Act is doing. But Russia's just tit for tat at this point.
Exactly. Let's move on to an even funnier headline, which is about the latest Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. And this is from the Washington Post. It's an opinion article, but I loved it. And here's the headline. I don't know Kavanaugh the judge, but Kavanaugh the carpool dad is one great guy. Well,
that is relieving.
He's not my vote if I'm a senator, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if you need a babysitter, he is for sure the guy. And that's what we're talking about, right? Is that what we're talking about? Yeah,
actually, he's a coach of his girls' basketball team. So. That's great.
That's
you know?
So great.
I'm all for it.
That's all I want. I have a friend who works in one of the federal courts here in D.C., and so she, has run into him in the halls. She says he's very nice. She deeply, deeply opposes his nomination, but this says he's very sweet. So, I mean, that's all we're really looking for, right?
Exactly. I'll just add one serious note, since people know I'm a Cuba solidarity activist and have been for many years. Brett Kavanaugh was one of the people fighting to keep Elian Gonzalez in this country and away from reuniting with his family. So now that we're all about reuniting kids with their families, which is, of course, a good thing, this is a guy who fought against that in the case of Elian Gonzalez, which fortunately he lost.
Wow. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I didn't know that.
Yeah, me neither. And this is basically how they sold Neil Gorsuch too, right? That, you know, obviously he's a hard right ideologue, but he's so nice.
You humanize him.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Yeah, you're right.
From the sublime to the ridiculous. The next headline is about Mike Pompeo. Everyone saw, I think, where North Korea characterized his last meeting with them as gangster-like because he had issued demands on North Korea, and he wasn't doing diplomacy. They weren't doing negotiation. They were doing like the U.S. always does, which is basically demanding what other countries should do. So the response from Pompeo, which was amusing, is in this headline from the New York Times: Pompeo sharpens tone on North Korea. The world is a gangster. So what Pompeo said is that if it were true that that he was a gangster, then the world is a gangster. So it was like, I know you are. What am I? You know,
that is really poetic. Actually, I'm really impressed.
Actually, on a serious note, I actually think he's right with one caveat, and that is, whenever you read about the world in the U.S. media or from U.S. politicians, like they talk about world opinion, they don't really mean world opinion. They mean the opinion of the rulers, the governments of the imperialist governments of the world. So with that proviso, the world is a gangster. I'm totally down with that statement.
If you just replace the world with imperialist countries, yeah, for sure. And then change the verb, obviously, for subject-verb agreement. Well, let's go up to, there's a really great in quotes piece by George Will that you flagged for us this week. Let's talk about that one.
Yeah, this is George Will, a well-known conservative, and he wrote an article for the Washington Post, and the headline reads, "What Might a Socialist American Government Do?" So who better to tell us what that would be? You know, could it be Brian Becker or someone who's, you know, an actual socialist? No, it's George Will, who's anything but a socialist. He's a conservative. And really, he thinks that socialism is just social democracy, which is certainly part of it in terms of, you know, free education and free healthcare and so on, combined with all the worst features of American government. So, for example, he talks about how, you know, a socialist government could well decide to promote, because they have such control, could be promoting coal over renewable energy. What he doesn't seem to understand, the basic problem with this article, is he doesn't seem to understand that a government free of corporate influence will make decisions very differently than a government which is totally dominated by corporations and by the profit motive. And that point seems to totally elude him in his diatribe about what's wrong with a potential socialist American government.
Yeah, in this piece he says, so an American socialist government might tell, say, Harley Davidson that the government knows better than they do where they should invest shareholders' assets. I think he's missing the point of the idea that
there
would not be a Harley Davidson, there would not be shareholders, and that we would all share wealth together. I think he's maybe missing that point.
Yeah, I actually want to, because, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beat Joe Crowley in the primary, and now Cynthia Nixon, who's challenging Governor Cuomo in New York in the primary, are calling themselves socialists. I mean, the idea of socialism and socialists is, you know, once again, making a lot of headlines here. And here's the serious point we want to make about this. The socialism is not like a laundry list of policies that a government implements, and you can be more or less socialist according to how many of those policies on the checklist you implement. Socialism is about power, right? It's about who controls power in the economy and in politics. Capitalism means people with capital, big businesses and corporations, and the rich people who control them, they have power under capitalism. Socialism means that workers and poor people and oppressed people have power over the economy and the government. That's the difference. Don't listen to George Will.
You're saying I shouldn't listen to George Will. Great guy, though. He's really nice.
Is he? He likes baseball, which I don't myself.
Well, let's move on to, there's a couple more really interesting ones. Do you want to move on to Germany and Russia?
Sure. This is the New York Times. And of course, Trump just yesterday or the day before described Germany as a captive of Russia and doing Russia's bidding because it dares to import natural gas from Russia. So the New York Times ran a very serious article entitled "Germany Imports Gas from Russia, But Is It a Captive?" And that just offended me, the idea that they would even treat this absurd
concept seriously and give it an article to give it the slightest credence whatsoever, even if the article, you know, eventually tries to rebut that claim. I mean, it's just, you don't need to take every absurd statement that Trump makes seriously. That's the wrong way to go, in my opinion.
I mean, there's so many. Yeah, and they're all so absurd. I think that's definitely the wrong way to go. What about, let's head down to Mexico. Do you want to hit that one?
Sure. And this is from Bloomberg. And this was a very offensive article to me, a headline anyway, an article. Mexico's AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, ditches bodyguards to foster man of people image. So what Bloomberg seems to want you to think is that it's all a fake. It's just an image that he's being a man of the people. They can't wrap their heads around the fact that there could actually be a politician, you know, who is a man of the people and who is not all about cultivating an image. Now, I'm not saying AMLO is that or isn't that. I don't know him that well. But, you know, my impression is that this is a valid, you know, this is not an image, this is him. And the fact that they don't even consider that, I just find really offensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if the U.S. press did the same thing and ascribed the most cynical possible motive to everything that U.S. politicians did. Like what if the New York Times ran a headline that said, "Senator thanks troops in effort to foster militarism in American society"?
That's a great example.
Exactly.
Well, we will leave it right there. That was Steve Pat. He joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. You can check him out on Twitter, at Left Eye Blog, LEFTI Blog. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.